Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2019. This is the fourth and final stream of tonight, which I think is the fourth night. And here I am with JF Garipi, the infamous and most beloved JF. So, hello, welcome, JF.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, now, first of all,
better than last year.
Yes, well, that's cheeky bugger. I was going to say that first thing first. I was going to say I did JF a disservice last year, as some of you will remember. By the time he came on, I was fucking shattered, and I just couldn't keep up with what he was saying. I did try, but I failed, and I felt bad about it ever since. Thankfully, this year, maybe it's just because it's relatively early in millennial stuff. You know, still got energy, or maybe I'm doing something different this year. I don't know. But either way, I've got more beans this time, so it should be fine. But anyway, we're going to discuss this decade. So from your perspective, I mean, obviously for you and me, this decade has had rather transformative effects on our lives. We've both become e-celebs. So, but I mean, apart from that, I think you've probably got quite a different perspective from mine. So, go ahead, talk about the world in 2020 and maybe your life in 2010, whatever you'd like to take this.
Absolutely. Well, in 2010, I was a PhD student and internet had risen, but it's hard to capture because the progresses between the year 2000 and 2010 are extremely well labeled. It's Web 2.0 that has risen. It's hard to say what changed after Web 2.0, because no one wants to call it Web 3.0, really, because when you think about Twitter, it's still Web 2.0. It's still people just creating content, and everyone is equal on the platform. Well, Wikipedia is there.
Hold on a second. Let's, for the sake of it, let's define what's Web 1.0, and then we'll go through 2 and go on.
Okay, so Web 1.0 was the websites, and it was the central authority publishes, users download the website. Web 2.0 was the rise of Wikipedia, Twitter, YouTube, social media, essentially. Everyone creates, and we now have public spaces. And I think that this is the great contribution of Web 2.0. But that being said, Web 2.0 was around in 2010, yet the world has changed in massive ways since 2010, but it's not the platforms. The platforms are the same. YouTube existed in 2007. Twitter existed in 2010. What has been gaining in this decade is the use of these platforms. And I would eventually argue later in the decade, the social engineering and shaping of the discussion by rules, which is a new thing on the internet. It's a new thing to have that much effort deployed at shaping third-party conversation. Because here I am speaking to you with consenting adults on the regular chats. They are listening to us. Yet there is an outside authority, YouTube, and there is Twitter and all these tech companies. They are deciding what I can tell to you and what people can hear. That is a novelty of the 2010 decade, and it's being rushed in the last 1 or 2 years in massive ways, which is extremely hurtful to creativity. And it's an error of the left, I think, because ultimately you cannot social engineer consent. You cannot force right-wingers to not think like right-wingers. And that's what they're trying to do.
Well, I wonder if they even know what they're trying to do. Maybe they're just trying to stop right-wingers from affecting those people in the middle who are the undecided.
Absolutely. I think that you're correct. They don't really know what they're doing. They think that, okay, they have this conception that radical speech leads to violence. And they have this simple equation in their mind, not realizing, of course, that it's in human nature to be discussing of various things and to be testing each other's mind and testing each other's boundary. It's also part of humor. A lot of humor is self-derision and attacks on others also. But it's a function of the human mind to be exploring these spaces of discomfort. And it's a normal developmental aspect of the male mind in particular, which often gets repressed, by the people around us. And unfortunately, our world is becoming so public and so embedded in this social media that there is not much places to run away from this, to run away from the control where two men can speak to each other and have fun. Unfortunately, the private life is returning right now as the only place where you can do that when you could have done that 5 years ago, 8 years ago. So that's the development we're seeing. It's that Web 2.0 has reached its peak potential and then it wasted it. It fought against itself.
Well, somebody earlier on, Zurius, made this point that the internet in the 2000s, and obviously in the 90s for even more so, was regarded as a wild west where you could just build your own thing and you could say anything. And I think initially, as I said to him, initially the social media giants, even after they became giants, respected this. I mean, Twitter, I think as late as 2012 or something, was saying that there was a guy who said, "We are the free speech wing of the free speech party." One of the CEOs or something said that. And YouTube, as I said before, up until about a year ago, was, I think, even more pro-free speech than Twitter in terms of how it behaved, at least. I mean, you didn't see channels just getting deleted. You didn't see the insane stuff that they're doing now. I mean, 2019 has been just like going through, as a YouTuber, and you know this very well, it's been like walking through a minefield. And then there are occasional barrages of enemy shells, and you just wait for the barrage to end to see whether you have survived and which of your friends has survived and who's gone.
Absolutely. And I think that that the people at YouTube may not realize, but they are putting their YouTubers under high stress. Personally, I wake up every morning of my life wondering, clicking refresh on my channel, literally. And there's going to be a morning where it disappears. And it's my method of life. It's like if you were to hold my job at a McDonald's like this over my head and every morning telling me, "JF, you might be fired," that would be psychological abuse. But this is what YouTube is doing with its entire creator teams
and not just the employees. Not just the political channels, but everyone.
Yeah. The political ones are being targeted specifically, but of course the others are getting nervous because any sort of misunderstanding, any misstep is not, there's no mechanism for redemption or pardon. It's, you're going to lose YouTube forever, and you're going to lose this as an opportunity to make business and contact people on the internet. There is still no pardon system for lifetime punishment in these bannings. Sargon of Akkad apparently will be banned from Twitter until he's dead. It's amazing, but this is what they're telling us.
You know, people laughed at me a year ago when I was frankly traumatized by my Twitter ban, and I say that with some embarrassment, but at the same time, I'm on my own side saying it as well, because I think, well, what else was I supposed to feel? Was I supposed to just be laughing about it? Nonchalant? I mean, of course it's going to be fucking traumatic to lose something like that, as anyone, but especially as a public figure. Anyway, people laughed at me when I said that I think Twitter, access to a Twitter account should be a human right. I stand by those words. I think that your social media thing, especially something that a lot of work has gone into, a YouTube channel, it should be regarded, as Sargon says, as private property, because it's something you have built, and it should not be up to someone else to just arbitrarily destroy it. You might not be up for this, but some people would say maybe the government, the courts, should have that authority, but not a private corporation. They should not have the authority to just destroy your livelihood. I definitely don't think that they should have that authority. I think it should be the done thing, that the assumption should be that unless in extreme situation, you cannot get banned from Twitter and you cannot get banned from YouTube. I think the idea of permanently, for the rest of someone's life, that person is an unperson on this platform. That person does not exist in that public space, that international global public square. I think that has to be seen as, it should be seen as morally untenable.
Absolutely, it's unjust, and specifically from the Canadian perspective, it's amazing, because Facebook and these tech companies are generally engaging in totally illegal behavior just by the current legal standard. We're not even talking about making new laws. Current legal standard is you cannot in Canada discriminate based on race. You cannot based on religion. You cannot based on even political beliefs. Yet Facebook is saying, white nationalism is banned of our platform. Okay, so is black nationalism okay? Then you're telling me really that you have a problem with me having a certain belief and being of a certain race. You are therefore discriminating by race. And this is what these companies are engaging in. And we can see the totally unequal effect that they have on the right wing versus the left wing. And so what we're faced with is a discriminatory enterprise. And unfortunately, if we had support of the mainstream politics, if we had Trump say something else than I'm monitoring the situation, that would be great, because we could think of a future, a close future, a near future where we can fix these. But I think that there is a set of interest in the mainstream politics to have a bunch of heads that they can smash on, to have moles that they can smash on, like the Groypers, like Nick Fuentes, like Richard Spencer. And I believe that in the near future, there is not going to be a push in mainstream politics and people like Donald Trump or even Donald Trump Jr., who could be a candidate in 2024. I don't think they will want to resolve this problem, even if in the end, what we're talking about is very, very good supporters of them. I mean, ultimately, Trump is in power because there were elements on his right wing that were voting for him. But he's not willing to reward them because he's playing another game. These people think that they can win the center and the center left of politics if they can, in unison, combat the right winger that we are, the people that we are, or other people like people who are identitarians of all kind. So this is the dire situation that we face, and it's going to get terrible and worse. And I've seen your interview with Jared Taylor. He seems to be very enthusiastic at the regain of nationalist force across the world. I have to say, I am not. The crushing that will come in this decade will be absolute and final. We will be left like pieces across the world, potentially getting together, maybe 30, 100 nationalists getting together eventually somewhere to restart. But the fights have been lost. And we are headed toward a decade of non-intelligence, non-engagement, strawmanning, Nazi bashing and Nazi name callings. And it's going to be terrible for the right wing.
And yet you said earlier that you thought the strategy of the left would fail.
The strategy of the left will fail because it's not by oppressing people that you convince them outside of their beliefs. So as far as our basis goes, they will keep listening to us. And the more we are oppressed, the more our victimization will be visible to our audience. That being said, it's not true through the speech control war that they're winning. The left will win because of the demographics race. And because we won't find a solution for it, the demographic situation will get worse. And that's how they will win. It's not through speech control, really, because I believe that speech control only makes you look terrible. In the end, there's going to be comedians willing to push the limits and make jokes around these precise censorship rules. I mean, it's freaking funny that we are in 2019 at the peak of technological development in the entire history of humankind, and yet we are pretty much under a 1984 type of control system for thought and not even governments at approval. That may be the most disgusting thing. It's that oppression was delegated by the government, especially in the US. It was privatized. It was handed to companies, and that facilitated it because companies can get around the First Amendment.
Yes. So then what do you think is going to happen? I mean, this is, do you think that, you know, basically that white people are going to be extinct? They're going to be replaced?
Largely, I think that was my prediction throughout the 2016, 2017, and it is still my prediction. I'm very enthusiastic about people taking consciousness and awareness of it, becoming conscious of who they are and being proud of who they are. And I think that this will give us also our redemption, our ways out and our ways to save ourselves. But it will be extremely hard. It will be extremely limited. I see the vast majority of Western nations being lost, and eventually we're going to survive by traveling across the world, jumping from nations to nation to avoid oppression. The oppression will get worse. What I predict is that we will be in a state of constant oppression and international travel and seeking for a survival opportunity for the next many decades, perhaps 100 years.
Fucking hell, you're really black-pilled. I didn't actually know how black-pilled you are.
Yeah, you have to see the forces that have been deployed against us, the media smearing, the politics, the convergence of interest of the media class, the center-right, the Charlie Kirks of this world. This set of interests is just, those were supposed to be your friends. they were supposed to be closely related to us politically. They are the arches to go after us. And that's a sign that we are essentially, we have been dehumanized. This is what's happening, which is exactly what happens before big wars, before civil conflicts, before genocide. We have been dehumanized, and we have been dehumanized to points where Dieudonné says in French that essentially being white, or being what he calls a deplorable in the French equivalent of the word is worse than being a rapist. And we've reached pretty much that point. Rapists can still go on Twitter, by the way. Murderers can still go on Twitter. But there are some people who have right-wing thoughts and they can't go on Twitter. Isn't that a sign of dehumanization if there's one? And what happens is that this will stack the dehumanization that they allow themselves under due process rules of today will be worse as our due process gets chipped at by the various forces of the left, Virginia being just an example. But The gun subject in Virginia is a very specialized example. What we are seeing across states and across dimensions of political life is a complete chipping away at any form of liberty and a takeover of governmental responsibilities that used to be private, including the raising of children, the designation of who controls children's life and parental time, the so-called visitations offered to men by family courts. Those are just some of the dimensions of life that we are delegating to the government in a kind of blob manner. It's as if the government was impeding more and more to the point where our countries and their mechanism are not recognizable from what my grandparents were talking to me about what their childhood was. This is grave, and it shows the force we're faced with. It's not a little thing. It's not going to be combated by going with tiki torches on the street. It's cute and everything, but it's not resolvable that way. The forces of democracy will crush us because people are against us.
So what hope, do you see any hope, or are you just sort of resigned to the end of the white race and the end of Western civilization?
Well, there is always hope as long as there is life. And as Jeff Goldblum says in Jurassic Park, and that is true, life always finds a way. But it's going to be a tough way. Most of the territories will be lost. Most of the structure of Western civilization will be lost. There is a redeeming and a silver lining, if you will, in the fact that people have been attracted to Western civilization for its productivity and because so much could be drained from it. But this draining activity that people are doing with our societies has its limits. Eventually, when everyone is benefiting from a corrupt system, there's nothing else that this system can produce anymore. So what I recommend for people like me and people who have your kind and my kind of ideology is to just disengage from society. Don't be a productive member of society. You can be a productive member of a certain thing like YouTube. I'm fine doing it. But I wouldn't engage in an everyday job. I wouldn't produce. I wouldn't pay taxes to these governments. Flee and survive and find ways to not contribute to the system anymore. Let the system starve. It's a system of exploitation that's running on an increase of productivity that none of the people currently alive have really done. It's been done in the past, and it's an economic growth, a systemic economic growth that we have seen for the last 200 years. It's going to reach a ceiling. There's going to be so many people wanting to unionize, wanting to have their little share of the pie, people who want to be employed even if they have characteristic A, B, C, anti-discrimination rules that force companies to accept everyone, even to the point of non-productivity. This system will crash. Let it crash and just try to be in a position where you can at least laugh at the fall.
Right. So what do you foresee as your own future then? I mean, presumably you don't see yourself as a YouTuber 2 years from now.
Oh yeah, I see myself as a YouTuber up to the end of my life. But my main effort has been to develop an isolation from society, to be able to be a YouTuber from a localization that is secret, being independent of the most I can from electricity companies. So being really self-sustainable to the extent possible and being unattackable, so distant from civilization that it's not worth it for an Antifa communist. They would need to buy a bus ticket and then they would need to walk kilometers in the forest to just find me. So I'm finding peace, and peace through self-sustainability is the solution if you can afford it. Unfortunately, it's not everyone that can do that. You cannot ask everyone to move to the North Pole like me and Mama JF did, but we are isolated here, we're protected, and I can continue my little intellectual contribution to the world. Unfortunately, it will be with very little engagement on the side of the people I criticize. Example being Sean, for example, his video on the bell curve. I don't expect him to respond to it. I don't expect him to engage honestly with my comments if he does. And much of the intellectuals, the public intellectuals that are old, like Richard Spence, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, or even the rising ones like Eric Weinstein. They're creating a whole fluff discussion around themes that back in the blood sports days, we have engaged honestly on these questions, and we have found a lot of the answers that today you can see Eric Weinstein on his podcast. He's a communist leftist, and he's like, why don't people want immigration? Have you watched a little bit of the arguments that we have? It's amazing how they appear to not know that everything has been going on the internet. They appear to not have engaged with our ideas. And that is one of the big problems of the coming decade. It's the absence of engagement, the absence of honesty, and the development of isolated bubbles.
And do you see that as a function of social media, the censorship? Or just the nature of social media?
It's a good question. I don't think it comes from censorship. I think it comes from the stupidity of people, essentially. We can't expect people to evolve toward rational brain processes. So we should expect straw men and just unengagement and just ridiculous stuff happening in the brain of most people. Genius has to be an exception because there's just no evolutionary pressure toward genius. So, and if there are no mechanism of society that allow to select the elite to be somewhat scientifically talented or literate in philosophy or other subjects, we find ourselves with a noisy system, a system, and that's the system we live in right now. It's a system where the people who are rising as academics are not particularly intelligent. I mean, they can write a grant demand to the government and they can play the game well, but they're not the geniuses that would have deserved the title of scientist 200 years ago. They're certainly not in that class, yet they get the jobs. And the pseudo-intellectuals that are engaging on the public space, people like Eric Weinstein, who says, I don't know why people don't want immigration. Where's the argument? Well, watch one or two video of me. Watch some videos from Black Pigeon Speaks. They don't. And so we're faced with a degradation of our intellectual capacities, which is combined with a degradation of our societies. And I don't think censorship causes it, but what happens is that there are algorithmic qualities at Twitter and YouTube that ensure to channel people down to what they like to hear rather than what they should hear. And there is no criteria for the search for truth in the YouTube algorithm. It's really self-satisfaction is the criteria. And I think it's not a bad thing, but it has bad effect. The bad effect is to create these isolated leftist bubbles where people will repeat memes that they have read on their regular chat. I know when I make a video about a leftist personality, they come on my chat and you can see them coming back with the same talking point. Visibly, they have not engaged in self-critical thinking or anything. They just repeat what they've heard on the chats. It's the nature of what, it's actually my second book. It will be called The Moral Signal. And this is what we're faced with. We're faced with a signal. It's a signal of social interactions bouncing between all pairs of individual, and it has its own life. It's a mechanism of coordination among mobs of people. And in a world where the mob has the political power, which we call a democracy, it's a sad world because the mob is becoming more and more dangerous. The mob is dehumanizing us. The mob has decided that we were the enemy to fight politically, the right wing of the internet. And so I can only be worried about what's to come.
Okay, so first of all, you said that you see yourself as a YouTuber, not just 2 years from now, but until for the rest of your life, which I presume is longer than 2 years. So, but at the same time, you talk about rising censorship. So how are you going to be on YouTube?
Well, up to now, the censorship has not been attaining me. I had one weakness on my show. It was guests. And the problem is I've been having some edgy guests who clearly were attempting actively to get me banned, like Emily Yukis, for example. So these guests I've banned from any future appearance. On my side, I can respect any rules you like. I'm essentially an autistic maniac of rule respecting. I can respect them and insult you at the same time. I will find a way to make a joke around these rules. I will find a way to talk of the subjects I want to talk about. But yeah, personally, I'm dedicated still to continue within YouTube. A lot of people have been saying, Jeff, don't self-censor, go elsewhere. For now, it doesn't work for me. I want my product to be consumable by the normies of today. It's not that I want to attract normies to my channel, but I don't want it to be a social exclusion to be watching JF. I would want people to be able, like they often report to me, they watch the JF show, the public space, with their wife on the TV. If you're not at that level, if you can go on BitChute and use all sorts of edgy jokes and use slurs. But if you're still, if you're not at that level where a man and a woman can sit on a couch and watch you and not be kind of, oh, that's too edgy, I'm not interested in going there. That being said, the alternative platforms, I will keep publishing on them, but I don't want to abandon the idea of a mainstream YouTube presence.
But what if they just decide to shut you down anyway? I don't want to make you any more black-pilled than you already are, but the censorship is getting worse and worse, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, if they decide, I will give up. But I will not give up voluntarily. If they decide to ban me, they ban me, and I can try to make a living off other platforms. The fact is, my first book has been so successful, despite your bad interview skills last year. My first book has led me to make enough money to be totally safe for the rest of my life. I've sold many, many, many books at a very high price. So personally, I can just keep
think
writing
how much
books.
Money you could have made if my interview had been even better.
So for this reason, I'm not super worried. We have a super safe place here. We have self-sustainability. I'm not a millionaire, but I don't need to work. I could write books for the rest of my life and not benefit from my YouTube income, and I would still be okay. So if they deprive themselves of my presence on YouTube, okay, but it would be a sad thing because this platform has created something special in the era of 2017, 2018. There was some intellectual engagement that was growing on YouTube that was absolutely different from anything that humanity has ever been faced before. And if they ban someone like me, they're losing that. They're losing a naive and candid exploration of ideas on the public space. And my God, that would be sad. It may be what they want to do, but that would be sad because where else would we redo it? Where else would the per philosophical ideas have to pass the test of the crowd, the test of the yells on the regular chat, the test of the challenges of the super chat, and the test that we had, which was in Blood Sports, there was a host, there was me, there was arbiters of the debate, and there was the debaters. There was no way you could bullshit. Unfortunately, we're back to a production and a creative mode of bullshitting. That's what we're back to with Sean, the bell curve attack. And I showed that, okay, if you believe everything that Sean says in his video, here's the consequence. And I showed that essentially his video doesn't show much, doesn't show anything, even if you believe it. Unfortunately, back then, we had mechanism to call out the strawman to say, look, this guy is not engaging with the real ID. Here's the real ID. And you could see the people getting destroyed live. And it was fun. It was fun to see Mond and Matt just lie for an hour and then be caught on the kill stream, have to show his logs, which revealed, oh no, he's been bullshitting us. He's been lying for an hour, and he's the one behind the reporting of other YouTubers in mass report ways. It was all fun, and it was all live, and there were egos destroyed, and there were people disappearing from the internet out of shame. It's going to be hard to see this in 2020 up to 2030.
What do you think about the fact that, or do you believe that the dissident right is growing? Do you believe that it's growing, more and more people every year?
No, objectively, I think that the movement will be bound to get smaller and smaller in proportion of the population. What's happening is that the movement of the right wing was very fringe, and now because of internet exposure, it has gained exposure. So it has gathered souls that were already there. They were already kind of right wing, but they didn't know that they could engage. So, of course, if you're a Jared Taylor or if you're the leader of some sort of organizations, the Patrick Casey, the Nick Fuentes with his America First stuff, you get a little more people connecting. But this is not a growth of right wing interest. This is just people who would have been right-wing in the past, and they just have more means of communication, means of getting together.
Hold on a minute. I know for a fact. I mean, people tell me all the time that I, discovering my channel, changed their politics radically. They were a centrist, or they were even a left-winger, or a liberal, progressive. I've had SJWs, that, or ex-SJWs, as even them, and libertarians, all types of people. So surely you get the same thing. Or maybe you don't. I don't know.
No, I mean, I do. But individual stories of change of mind are irrelevant here. We're playing a demographics game. It's a matter of mathematics. The fact is that the people who come to you and they are absolutely convinced that you are the one who changed their mind, they would have had a right-wing revolution in another time with another speaker. The fact is that mathematically, the right wing is not growing. I'm sorry.
Well, hold on a minute. Then what is the point of advertising then? I mean, what's the point of any kind of communication? If people are inevitably fated to do what they're going to do anyway, then there's no point doing anything.
You're right. But I like to say it as the last standing man. I like to give people the opportunity to consent or not consent. It's the same thing with my book, by the way, The Revolutionary Phenotype. I don't think we can fight the eventual modification of our genes by machines and the eventual complete transformation of human society into farmed blocks of matrix-supporting energy pills, essentially. It's a short story, but it's what's coming. And I don't think we can fight it. But what we can do is a little bit like the movie 300. We can be the man standing and accepting their death and saying, I will not let my death happen in silence. I will be yelling freedom as I die. It's pretty much the sense of my engagement, of my intellectual engagement. It is a last scream of a dying nation. And I'm even in more advance of a state of a dying nation because I'm not an American with the hope that the Christian maybe will make enough baby. I'm not a Scottish with maybe the hope that the Brexit will awaken some nationalistic feeling. I'm a Quebecois. I'm 30 years further down the line of the extinction of my own people. I'm not even speaking my own language right now. And so I know what it is to be in a dying nation. I know it because I see your future, the future that awaits people of America and the UK and France, is what happened to the Quebecois for many decades now.
Well, why don't you just all right? Okay, what about moving back to France?
Moving back to France?
Yeah, I know you weren't born there, or whatever. You haven't lived there, but surely, you know, strength in numbers.
France is not salvageable. France is in a worse situation than most. When I think of the worst situations, I think Sweden, France, maybe Canada. And moving back to France, is this a joke?
Well, then how about inviting French people over to Quebec?
Oh, yeah. I mean there certainly needs to be
a path of defeat.
No, but I mean, I'm warming a little space of planet Earth, which would be perfect for all these French people, all these Scottish people, and all these Americans once they realize that they cannot sustain their current territory. So you'll all be welcome in my little village on the North Pole. You need self-sustainability. You need to be able to handle the winter, but I'll be here and I'll be welcoming people. But I don't feel that this is something to come in the next few years because people are kind of at the intersection between a delusion that they can still win and a resolution that they never will. And until you have attained this resolution that you never will, you're still going to be involved in your politics. You're still going to believe that eventually your government could be turned toward your own interest. It never will. But until you realize this, I can't really help you. And I can't invite you to my North Pole secret bunker.
Damn. I was hoping for many evenings of being black-pilled, and as you're doing now. Let me ask you, what could make you feel not black-pilled? I mean, what would make you think, actually, it's worth fighting? There is a chance.
If we were in a world where everyone seems to be connected into a set of common belief of decency, of the need to pursue the greatness of the past, and of a willingness to pay the price of the pursuit of the greatness of the past, I would be maybe less black-pilled. But that is clearly not what I see.
I agree that's not the current situation, but surely that's 10 steps away. It's not the first step. That's a goal. It's not a starting point.
Well, okay, but then what would lead me to not be black-pilled is to see a possible path from our current circumstances to that goal. And I don't see it, because the reality is the thing that made us great is not what we think. And the thing that lead to great societies rising is not what people think. People think that they can master the makings of society like the little social engineers that they think they are. And that is a great delusion of democracy, and a great delusion also of being born simply in a time where economy has always been going well, has always been on the growth. We are in a kind of deceptive ramp up of our economy that leads us to adopt beliefs about the future, that it's always going to sustain itself, that there is never going to be drawbacks, that we can make the world better. The delusion of progressivism, which is never how we progressed. That is the great deception of our time. The lie that we can become great by making us great, that we can make ourselves great. That's not how we become great. The process that leads to greatness is one of evolution, chaos, anarchy, and unsatisfied demands, lives lost, and eventually something better emerges out of chaos, out of war, out of constant refinement. Not refinement because we want to, but accidental refinement of our genes as we enter this wide competition that survival on planet Earth is. No leftist wants to hear that.
I think that not many people would want to hear that. What you seem to be saying is that there's no point even setting a goal, because everything just happens blindly and through chaos. Really?
Exactly.
I mean, surely people decide on things and then pursue them.
The minute you set a goal, you actually make it harder to reach an evolution. Suppose that you want to make people more intelligent. And so you start public schools, you start educating everyone. Oh, you got your measures, the Flynn effect. People have been getting more intelligent as they got to public school for 10 years, 20 years, 70 years. And then what? Then you've just created a system that would eventually make people less intelligent. It's unavoidable. When you try to fix evolution, evolution works against you. So here you are trying to make people more intelligent by doing what? By essentially delivering parental care to young children, which would have been delivered by parents only 100 years ago. So you've replaced the parental authority. You now have children that are dependent, and they're evolving to be dependent on the state to become intelligent. And during this time, the genetic quality of people disappears slowly, and you're not even seeing it. 50 years late down the line, 100 years down the line, you wake up and you have people who are incapable of caring for themselves, who need the state to deliver parental rights to them. You have parents that have evolved to be incompetent and cannot deliver these caring behaviors toward their children. You have inserted a path of evolution that makes you worse by trying to make you better. When you try to make yourself better, generally through social engineering, you end up making yourself worse.
But surely what you seem to be saying is that basically there's no point setting any goals at all because it just won't work and it will even backfire. But I don't see that as an inevitability. Why is that inevitable?
It is.
You know, I mean, you seem very blind, like as if everything is just going to go badly and wrong.
It is inevitable because the mind of people evolves in circumstances of chaos and anarchy, and yet the minds of people then want to contain the chaos and control the anarchy. And I've pushed this system as far as I could, as far as the human mind could allow me to push it. And the worse you get is this, the revolutionary phenotype. It's that your desire to improve humans at best will not work and at worst will cause massive dysgenic pressure that you hadn't planned in your social engineering project. But suppose that you would be right. Suppose that you were to calculate exactly which gene you want in your future babies and print their genes. Eventually, the printer takes over. So there's really no way out. The realization of my book is that the worst you could do is be a successful social engineer, because eventually you would create a machine that would start farming you and start abusing its capacity to determine your gene to put it to its own interest.
Yes, I remember that from, even though I was half asleep, I do remember that from the previous interview. But it seems to me that, let's say that you had a battle. You were part of a bunch of guys fighting a battle, and they were saying, okay, so what are we going to do? Well, what's the plan here? You surely wouldn't respond by saying, okay, well, it is impossible to change human nature, and you can't determine an end goal for how you want people to be. And no, you wouldn't do that. You'd say, well, okay, here's the battleground, and here are the resources we have, and you know, here are some possibilities.
Well, there are circumstances where the coordination of behavior between teams of humans makes them gives them an advantage over the enemy. I don't deny that sometimes you coordinate to survive. That being said, I will point out that this gathering of people and this, okay, we're going to walk there and we're going to surprise them, you could very well be sending your own army to its own death. So coordination...
Or its victory.
Yeah, or its victory, exactly. So it's not a determining factor whether you coordinate with other, whether you put belief in your actions or not. It's not a determining factor in your survival. And in fact, it can be determining one or the other, that you're going to live or that you're going to die.
Yes. Well, this is the point that I'm making. It seems that you're saying that there is this one challenge, which is a big challenge to change society and to, you know, wake up European people and so on. And that then you leap from that to a utopian goal that is unattainable. But you know, I'm not asking for the utopian goal. I'm asking for this one, which is much, much less ambitious.
Well, because between the utopian goal and the first step, there is the persuasion of people. But I know how people get persuaded. And I know that people don't evolve right now to have the cognitive characteristics to even want self-sustainability and care and independence from the state. To the contrary, we've been farming state dependence into our own nations forever. Well, for as long as the state has existed. So I cannot entertain a scenario in which suddenly I find the right arguments to convince all of the leftists of being right-wingers. I mean, we can make up fiction, but this delusion of persuasion is one of the things I try to fight, one of the things that is pushed by people like Sam Harris. First, being wrong that Sam Harris, in my view, that there is a truth matter into the domain of morality. That is, that the subject of morality is factual in nature. But secondly, this assumption that you'll be able to persuade people. We don't have much studies on persuasion, but what we know is that the directions of history are not determined by great men who just found great ways to phrase stuff. The movements of history are based on resources, a fight for existence, an availability of food, period. It's not that, it's not the argument. It's not an argument that has risen one army against the other.
But hold on a second. I'm not suggesting that people are rational or logical. I haven't thought that for many, many years. I'm saying that they are open to being persuaded through other means. Most people are not logical. I know that.
They're not open to be persuaded. There is no such thing as persuasion. Persuasion is an anecdotal observation of changes of cognition in limited amounts of people who engage limitedly in limited reconsiderations of some of their views. Largely, what we're talking about is pools of people who are actually predetermined already as to the conclusion they will reach given a certain philosophical problem.
But we know that most elections, the majority of voters haven't even decided until the day of the election.
Well, the idea of a decision is a big illusion. What people are reporting is really their consciousness and their subjective experience of having deciding. But the game is already set in their brain. The networks are already there. They're all ready to fire, to sprinkle their excitations left and right until a decision is reached, until it is filled. But the neurons are already there. The networks are already there. The preferences are already encoded genetically. The genes have already competed across years. And the sum of these combats just shows up in a decision that someone says, I feel like I want to vote for Donald Trump. The game has already been played for 500 years before.
Then why is so much effort and money expended in political campaigning?
Because among the factors that can influence a decision is exposition to just regular images and themes of a campaign. So it's not that human behavior is unchangeable by the environment. It's just that the changes are predicted and deterministic. That's all.
So let's change the environment.
Well, here's the thing. You're fighting with a bunch of people who are already controlling this persuasion machine, and they have infinite resource compared to you. The idea that you will, through rationality only and through just being right, win over this giant machine that is born out for the precise purpose of public manipulation, and that has enriched the people who use it for centuries, the idea that you will pop out from some basement studio with bizarre lights behind you and find the
sexual lights,
it won't work because you're fighting.
My bisexual lighting will win the battle, JF, and you know
you're Look at Nick Fuentes. Nick Fuentes today is getting attacked by Meghan McCain from The View, daughter of John McCain, by Megyn Kelly, ex-mainstream Fox News host, and by Nikki Haley, ex-diplomat of the United States of America. These three people today are dunking on Nick Fuentes.
Oh, that makes me...
Do you measure the intensity of this? It's like this system is it has its own antibodies. It's willing to fight you like you're a virus, and it will fight us.
Of course it will fight us, and it is fighting us. And Nick Fuentes is... you know, whatever my differences with him and whatever, you know, we've sparred in the past, he's in on the fight, and I, I'm I admire him. I'm glad that he's around. He's doing what he can. And I wonder, are you doing what you can despite yourself? Because you keep trying.
I'm doing what I can, which is absolutely nothing. That being said, I can do information because as a scientist, and I'm so autistic and so lover of truth, I have this special relation to truth, which can give me an informative place in a social network. In other words, people may very well come to my channel to know facts and to know the structure of arguments. I'm very good at that kind of thing. So to the extent that there is a demand for truthful information, I can respond to that demand by making shows of the public space and analyzing everything that happens during the day or some arguments in particular.
Yeah, of course, and you are very rational and logical, but even that is directed by one's psychological state. I mean, you clearly are, I mean, just in the course of this interview, you seem very attracted towards defeatism, attracted towards pessimism, let's say.
Oh, I'm an eternal pessimist. That comes with being a French nihilist, and sometimes pessimism is needed to remain connected to reality. Look at the state of our world.
So is optimism, though. So optimism is all, because pessimism itself can be a crutch and a virus.
The thing is, I've seen enough of humanity to know that it's not a respectable thing. I don't like the directions we've taken. We are extremely cruel to each other. Just the evil that shows in everyday life in this species is just absolutely disgusting to me. I know you told me in your letter of invitation that you wanted me to cheer people and keep a Christmas ambience. I don't know.
I gave up on that about 56 minutes ago.
We're talking about a world that has systems of lying, smearing, that is willing to, as soon as it detects that you're a right winger, is willing to call your exes, make them make false statements about you, lie about you on the media. Journalists that don't even care about reporting the truth will just pull a big amount of shit over your head just to destroy you, just to neutralize you. And then there's going to be other pulling shit over your head if you keep being a little more exposed. And it doesn't stop there. There is all sorts of invasions of rights happening at the personal level. You'll get attacked in family court if you're a right winger. They will take your children. Child Protective Service will come to take your children also if you happen to be against the system, if you happen to be a dissident thinker. There's no end to this. And the thing is, relatively to what has been done before in humanity, which is absolute savage war, destruction, scalping, and torture, the thing is, we've not even seen the worst yet. It's going to be worse for right-wingers. In 10 years from now, in 20 years from now, the direction of the world has been set. You won't change the direction of a demographic movement so massive that it's actually continued over the last 100 years. We are headed toward an extremely left-wing, extremely anti-male, extremely demoralizing, anti-right-wing, extremely violent world. And this is just the beginning. Freedom J on the regular chat says JF needs a vacation. No, I'm actually doing good. I'm actually happy in life, but let's be honest.
So you said that you're unimpressed by humanity. Most people are not. They don't win your favor. What would make you say the opposite?
Well, I'm just unimpressed by humanity when I think of the average. When I think of the average human on Earth, and its cruelty, its moral coordination, its idiocy, and its willingness to refer to strawmen and irrational lines of thought. That being said, what could give me a hope in humanity is if it was able to look at its elites and say, I admire it. I admire this person, and I don't have to be the elite. It could be just Frédéric Chopin. We could just agree that it's a great pianist, but it's not even where we are at.
But hold on, right, that presupposes that people understand that Frédéric Chopin is a great pianist. They need to be given that knowledge, that understanding. And without that, of course they're going to not appreciate Chopin.
Absolutely. And my point is, I wouldn't even need for you to agree with me that it has to be Chopin. But I would have people to have a kind of drive to look at the best of us and try to emulate and admire. But it's not even where we are. We are at the point where people will look at the best of us and say, oh, here's an expression of the patriarchy, and oh, he's there because he was white. And it's we don't even have a system to pull people from the bottom and elevate them, which was supposed to be the role of education, by the way, before it changed its program. And instead of raising people to the top, it started smashing on the heads of those who were popping out as too intelligent, too original, too dissident, and try to get them down to the average. It's a sad world.
Yes, it is. But again, you're speaking not about intrinsic human nature, but human nature under certain conditions. So I think that you should be more forgiving of people in general, basically, because of course they're stupid. I mean, that's what they are. That's what they're like. They are sheep. It's not the end. That is not a cause for despair or defeatism.
Well, to be honest, I'm not saying that just because people are stupid, I hate them. It's not really this, because the reality is I'm actually tolerant of the cognitive diversity of people, including unintelligent people. I'm not too annoyed by unintelligence or too low intelligence in our civilization, but I'm annoyed at the inherent defeatism of this drive to equality, which is invading all possible domains, including science,
Hold on a minute. What about the inherent defeatism of this drive to determinism, which you're voicing?
Well, determinism is something you can't escape. It's a truth of the physical world. The physical world and any physical world, any universe in which you are instantiated as an evolutionary agent with genes making babies, is deterministic. You're going to evolve towards certain directions. You can think of it as the atoms bumping onto one another. It's a mathematical equation, and it's going to play out. It's not a defeatism to be acknowledging the truth. It would be delusionism to be denying it.
Well, again, it seems to me that this is something where you choose how your emotional state dictates. Are you going to be pessimistic or optimistic about this? I don't see it as being predetermined that we're just doomed.
The thing is, I call the rule by the average pessimistic, but it's not really what's annoying to me of it, because ultimately I have nothing against pessimism or positivism. To me, the world just plays out. So I have no conception. As a moral nihilist, I have no conception of this being bad or good, ultimately. But what I don't like is that the pulling toward the average is not only keeping the elites from realizing their best potential, but it's even not even in good service to the entire crowd. Really, when people are taking the geniuses and pulling them down to their level, they are depriving themselves of innovation, of growth, of learning, of imitation opportunities. It's sad for everyone, really. We're transforming something that could have been a look into the future, into a bright future, where we would try to do as the best of us and try to emulate the best of us. And we're saying, no, we're going to transform this into a zero-sum game where you have to fight me first. We're essentially acting like bullies toward the intelligent people of our world and the people that are most caring also. Jared Taylor likes to say, if you want to save the whales, save white people first. Right now we're bashing on the most empathic people who could have had a good contribution to this planet.
Oh, I completely agree. And it's disgusting because white people are the ones who have created this civilization and these cultures that we value and that we all benefit from. And yet they are the ones who are constantly vilified and bullied. I see it very much like a bully at school, you know, with his victim, and he works by psychologically disabling the victim. I see it. It's alarming sometimes how close that analogy is to what's happening to white people today.
Exactly. That's what's happening. And, you know, I've not been hugely bullied in my elementary school, but I was a geek, so I've seen a little bit of bullying. I've gone through a little bit of bullying, and it's so heartbreaking to arrive in adulthood and think that it's over, but to find that the entire world is essentially a system of bullying, that the entire social media has been taken over by the bullies, not by the intelligent people of the elementary school.
Would you say that at heart you are a disappointed utopian?
Yes, I guess, because when I was young, I did have much more open life, much more idealism in all fields of life, legal rights, science, facts, understanding of the universe. I find that the social world is extremely disappointing. That even when your intellectual heroes don't even engage with your points philosophically. When I see Richard Dawkins still 1 year after the publication of my book, which is a response to the selfish gene, I called it the revolutionary phenotype, as opposed to the selfish gene. It's a follow up. It's a response, and it's a good book. Having seen that he has not even answered, I find myself with intellectual heroes that are impotent intellectually, that are not engaging with my words. It's as if it's the feeling of having fathers and gods all disappeared. And that may be part of where my nihilism comes from. It's the great disappointment of the social world being more a game and less a dream, less something that we would do together. I don't think that much people on this planet engage really in intellectual pursuit, honestly.
One thing that is sometimes said about the disappointed idealist is that basically, if you had more realistic expectations, then you would avoid being disappointed and therefore avoid the psychological harm that comes with being disappointed. What would you say about that?
There may be something like this. Personally, what my drive is more like a Joker type of drive. It's like, if the world is so evil, I'm going to try to, and I mean it very metaphorically, but metaphorically, I'm going to try to put sticks in their bicycle to make it hard for the people who are operating this machine of oppression and social unhealthy behavior. I'm just going to make it hard. And that's how I see my contribution to the world.
I think that there's a lot of tragedy here, JF. I think that you are a guy who is very capable and could make a wonderful contribution, and that you've been hurt because your contribution hasn't been appreciated yet.
Well, that is not the big drama, because my contribution is the truth. So my book will resist the test of time. And even if it's not in my living life, my book eventually will be recognized as the last theory of biology, the completion of every single interrogations that we had about evolution, the last fundamental answer to how life emerges. That is a given to me. And I don't live in the kind of sadness of not being recognized now or not being recognized before I die. I don't give a shit about all this. I find sadness in the self-deceptive direction that humanity is taking, and the fact that even our academia is not engaging, not with my book, but not with all sorts of other works in the domain of race and IQ, which I don't really give a shit about that much. I don't really care about this subject, but just to see people claiming that they are the agents of the search for truth and being so self-deceptive and so politically correct in their pursuit, it's more sad for them. It's not so much me that's crying. It's the empathic part of me when I see these clowns pretending that they are the searchers of truth. I cry for their own hypocrisy, and I cry by social empathy for their own littleness.
I can see all of that, but it also does affect you because it's turned you into a nihilist. Pessimist.
Well, that I probably was a nihilist before, so
but now you have a rationale for it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you spend your observations in life, and they confirm your belief, and you become crystallized in your beliefs, and then you die. But that I'm okay with all this. I'm also a guy who finds all of this very funny, and so I'm not going to go on my bed after this interview and cry. I'm just going to be laughing my ass off, just thinking about the world. So it's important in this process to also just laugh. I mean, think about it. We're a bunch of atoms that got together 4 billion years ago. Some DNA bout came in, and then eventually we became monkeys and apes and people who chat with keyboards on social media. And it's deeply funny that it's the way it went.
It is important to laugh, but it's also important that the laughter is not an escape and is not secretly, quietly poisoning you.
Oh, well, I'm not being poisoned. I mean, I'm enjoying looking at this pile of shit. I'm enjoying it deeply. And I have nothing. I could die tomorrow. I could die in 60 years from now. And I will be extremely happy about having existed and having seen it.
Well, that's good. But I do think that there's a chance that this detachment is not good for you. That's all I would say.
Millennial was a psychological help. This is funny.
Well, you're not the first. Anyway, shall we leave it at that? Or, oh, hold on, super
yes.
Chats. Hold on a second. All right. If you weren't receiving revenue from your content, would you continue sharing your knowledge and spreading your message with the same energy?
I would, but I don't know if I could deliver the same volume. Definitely the fact that I can do one show a night. I mean, I'm at episode, 680? I've been literally having no vacation, having just 2 days of vacation here and there to do some traveling and studio move. But really, I've not been having a vacation for the last 2 years of my life. And I'm okay with that, but I couldn't continue this volume if I was making zero out of it.
Right. Okay. I think that's a fairly typical response. I mean, this is why donations are important. One of the reasons. Okay. Someone says JF is a white flight advocate.
Yes, in a way. Faced with certain forces in life, fleeing is sometimes the best solution. Now, that doesn't mean flee anytime and flee anywhere and in any situation. But look at me. I fled with a beautiful woman, Mama JF, fled far from civilization. We spend the rest of our life here eating top foods, being heated by the wooden stove. Would you want something better than this? I mean, really. White flight seems like a good idea when it's done that way.
Right, okay. Merry Christmas to you both. My question is if you two are familiar with propertarianism, and if you think it has a place in the nationalist movement, why or why not?
Of course, I've been exposed to proprietarianism because I've had Kurt Doolittle on my show and I've discussed with John Mark. So it depends on, it's still a undefined philosophical position that ultimately boils down, in my view, very much to libertarianism. But then it says other things. It says, well, many of the properties that we're talking about are abstract, like the right to care about your children. That would be a property that proprietarianism cares about. Well, libertarianism also does, but libertarianism doesn't develop the entire abstract system of, okay, that's because your child is a property. And in fact, every action you do in the world, that's a form of property. You have property impact in the world. Also, one other thing that proprietarianism seems to care about more is the development of the commons. The idea that, you know, roads, the libertarian says, roads, there will be people building roads and we can use them. Because there's going to be so much benefactory drive from these rich people that they will just make the roads. The proprietarian care more about the development of actual public commons from government-like entities. So in that sense, the proprietarian is less anti-government than the libertarian. That being said, does it have a place? Certainly. But I'm not convinced yet that we are faced with a specific isolated system of thought. I think it borrows a lot from libertarianism, and then ultimately I am afraid that it is subject to the same defects as statism.
Right, okay. John Doe says, thank you for that donation, John Doe. Final question. How, and this is a bit of a jokey question to end a fairly hardcore, intense stream with. How were Mama JF's mushroom and Swiss burgers, and where can we get the recipe?
I think there's different places where you can get that kind of burger. It's hot stuff.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much, JF. Was this enjoyable?
Yes, it was a great chat. I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I wanted to, if nothing else, to make up for last year. So I think I've done that. And I do hope that your book sells, especially given what we've been talking about recently in this stream. The Revolutionary Phenotype.
Absolutely.
By Jean-François.
It's on Amazon. And by the way, on December 23rd, I have a Christmas dinner. Don't watch the public space at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I have a 13-course menu prepared by me and Mama JF. We're going to make a degustation of all of this.
Fucking hell. 13 courses?
Yes, absolutely. We have old duck. We have Cornish hen. We have 3-month age dry ribeye. We have lamb chops, we have cream corn, salt, we have 7 different appetizers. It's going to be spectacular.
Yeah, I would say so. That sounds very good, very worth watching. Okay, so I think that's it. That's all the questions. All right. So, JF, thank you very much for taking part in Millennial 2019. All right.
It was a pleasure.
Okay, and thank you to everyone for watching. I think this was the fourth night. I'll be back tomorrow night with, okay, The Jolly Heretic, Edward Dutton, Unwashed, The Distributist, and then Dangerfield. So that should be a very different night from this one. So, okay, thank you to everyone for watching. Thank you to JF for participating, and I will see you all tomorrow night.